A couple of announcements. First, I sent everybody, all of you, an email at the request of a student who needs a ride, asking that all people who have rides to offer put their addresses and emails on a new Google Doc, which I gave you the link for, so that people will know who to contact to make it as convenient as possible. So I'm not going to try to actually do matching of riders and cars, but I think that will facilitate it enough. Yeah.
I have a question. I was looking back through the list, and I thought that in the last one that you sent out, it didn't say anything about costs. But does this cost?
Oh yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How
right.
How do we do that?
So, yeah. So you have to. I pay the camp. I mean the conference center. And then you all reimburse me.
Okay.
So it's $40 a person.
Okay.
If that's a hardship at all, you can, and don't feel embarrassed about it and just give me what you can. I mean, I don't, you know, I really don't mind picking up the slack. It'd be more of a stretch to pay $40 for everybody, but you know. So seriously, if it really is a hardship for any of you to pay $40, just, and I know it might feel awkward to say, so don't feel awkward. After all, the whole course is about social justice and unjust inequalities. By any reasonable theory of social justice, I'm overpaid. You know, seriously, but any professor that gripes about their pay is living in a different on a different planet, if they have any theory of justice other than get what you can and you're justified in grabbing it. You know, that theory of justice, a purely kind of social Darwinism, dog eat dog, everybody's out for themselves, get what you can theory of justice, yeah, then nobody's overpaid. But any reasonable theory of justice doesn't create jobs that have the highest level of self-direction, autonomy, fulfillment, and enjoyment, and pays people, which on a global inequality scale puts them in the top, what, 0.25% of the world's population? I mean, I don't know what the world's income distribution looks like exactly. Sort of in the top 5 or 10% in the U.S., top 0.1% globally. So, all of this is just to say, anybody for whom $40 is at all a hardship, just pay what you can, and then I'll pay the camp in any case. I'll write them a check at the conference center, and then it'd be good to bring either cash or a check to me on Saturday at the conference. Okay. I've confirmed the sad fate of the tavern up the hill from the camp, and it is no longer open. So our classic routine of after our party at the lodge, going up to this wonderful but now dead bar and playing pool and dancing to their jukebox and hanging out till 2 or 3 in the morning, that fortunately or unfortunately, depends upon your view of the matter, is no longer part of the evening's plan. So that means we should, in order for the evening plan at the lodge to have some revelry to it, we have to generate our own entertainment more vigorously. As I've said before, anybody who plays any kind of instrument, I encourage you to bring them. If you have drums or noisemakers, that's fine too. I know there's going to be a couple of fiddles and at least one guitar, so that's a start, but the more the better for that. The other thing I thought we might do is if you have favorite weird YouTube things that you like, that you enjoy and you like to show people, particularly if they're funny, you know, this is not meant to be the evening is not meant to be a time for deep contemplation, but you know, I suppose a little bit of deep contemplation could be in the mix, but if you have something that you think is particularly engaging, we'll have a good projector and we can have a little bit of YouTube watching, people sharing their favorite special corners of the cyberspace. I'll also just warn you, I do subject everyone to some square dancing with my fiddle. And so I don't know if anybody here has been at one of these events, but in the other class there's a couple of veterans who have been to a preview, because they took this class too. So the schedule, by the way, I've pretty much set. We will do all of the Real Utopia research reports from the class on Saturday, and then Sunday morning will be our time for the intense discussion of socialism, alternatives to capitalism, which also means there were at least one or two people who said they couldn't come Saturday but were thinking about coming Sunday morning. And you'd need to get, if you're going to do that, you'd have to get there by 9. The Sunday morning thing will probably be sort of 9 to 11, so that people will be able to leave before noon to get back to whatever they need to do in Madison. All right, Anita, let's see if there's any. Oh, one other, yeah.
Did you Kate. Saturday?
What?
We're only going until Saturday morning.
No, it starts Saturday morning and goes until Sunday. Saturday night.
Okay.
It's Saturday morning.
Okay, for some reason, okay.
All day Saturday.
Okay, and then Sunday.
Saturday night's our party.
Okay.
Sunday morning is our, for this class's special workshop. Okay?
Gotcha.
I don't think there's any other, we're not going to get snow. There'll be no tobogganing, alas. It'll be cold on the weekend. The high temperature is supposed to be 15 or 16, something like that. We can do some traipsing around in the woods. There is some pretty walks we can still do, but the toboggan adventure will not happen this year round. One other announcement: Eve Caban is the Haven Center lecturer this week. His theme for the week is Another City is Possible. He's a very interesting urban planner, social theorist, teaches at London School of Economics. He's from Belgium. He works very closely with the United Nations and is heavily involved globally in issues of land rights, communal land ownership, transforming cities by creating urban agriculture and communal housing, cooperative housing, and all sorts of things like that. He's a kind of freewheeling, somewhat wild thinker about all these things. Has lots of United Nations experience consulting on these matters in very distant corners, including China. He's spent quite a bit of time in China on land tenure issues connected to urban development, but from a very progressive, real utopian point of view. So he's going to be giving talks at the Haven Center this week, Tuesday and Wednesday at 4:30, and a seminar on Thursday, 12:15 till 2. But he's also going to come for the weekend, so you'll have a chance to see him there. It would be nice if you could take in one of his lectures, given that he'll be hanging out with us all weekend. It'd be a chance for you to kind of see what he's up to. The lectures will be posted online, so you can listen to them even if you can't come to them today or tomorrow. All right? Your papers are due next Thursday. And I thought, you know, since we're having this weekend on Real Utopias and we'll have our workshop on socialism on Sunday morning, I thought this session on the 12th, on the last Thursday, you know, the last day of class when you hand in your papers, the best use of that session would be thinking about the whole semester, kind of putting all this together and revisiting other topics and having it be a kind of free-floating dialogue about that. I'll have some things to say, but it won't be in the form of a kind of an hour exposition about the whole semester. So we'll use that as the focus for that last session of the class. Okay. So this week, we're going to be finishing up the discussion of the theory of history. Today, I will be giving some critiques and rethinking of the general theory of history. And on Thursday, turning to what I call the special theory of capitalist history. So just to remind you of these two components and how they sort of fit together, what the point is. Marxism is often thought of, it's often called historical materialism. That's another name for the Marxist tradition, historical materialism. Historical materialism, the word historical in historical materialism, is stronger than just saying that all of our theories have to be historically situated. That is, that there are not any universal structures that exist everywhere for all time. So there is a tradition in social theory that is ahistorical in that sense. It attempts to argue, for example, game theory is an ahistorical theory. It argues that prisoners' dilemmas exist in hunter-gatherer societies and in post-industrial Sweden. Prisoners' dilemmas are a universal feature of the human condition. We can theorize them abstractly and we can apply them concretely to hunter-gatherer societies and to Sweden. And we can develop a theory of society based on those kinds of modular elements, which applies anywhere in all time. And you can build up a pretty comprehensive theory that helps you diagnose problems in all places at all times, with no specificity at the level of the abstract theory. This, of course, there's specificity when you apply it, but not specificity in the abstract theory. We have ahistorical theories that are very powerful about some things. You know, human physiology, we pretty much believe that our bodies work the same way now as in ancient, you know, pre-class societies and hunting-gathering societies. And one of our reasons for explaining certain kinds of problems the human body faces in the world today is that it indeed did evolve under those earlier conditions, so that under the present conditions, our bodies don't work so well if we sit all day long. Hunters and gatherers did not sit all day long. So our bodies were created, were evolved under one set of conditions. They're used in other conditions. The changing environment of our use of our bodies is part of the explanation, but the underlying physiology, people assume pretty much the same now as 50,000 years ago. Well, ahistorical sociology would make the same argument about social institutions. The same mechanisms are present everywhere and all for all time, but of course they get configured differently at different points in time. Well, historical materialism is historical in that sense. It's also historical in that sense. It says you need historical specificity. But it's really a stronger effort to develop a theory of history. It's an attempt to actually explain. I'm repeating stuff I've said a bunch of times. To actually explain the course of history. That's a really ambitious thing to try to do. Not just the course of particular historical developments. So you could have a theory of the French Revolution, which begins 50 years before it happens, and talks about the unraveling of the French absolutism and its pressures to engage in warfares that it can't afford, so that it becomes bankrupt and therefore, et cetera, et cetera. You can have a theory of that trajectory from the mid-18th century culminating in the Bastille and the overthrow of the monarchy. That is a theory of history, but of a very specific history. No, historical materialism attempts something way grander than that. The general theory actually wants to explain the broad contours and trajectory of all of human history, from primordial past through the present, demarcated by stages. The tricky word, the stages of history, where history has a development across those stages and pointing to a destination. That's why I think the theory of history is rather like the theory of the development of an individual human being, where we have well-defined stages. We have names for those stages. Toddler is a name for a stage. Child, adolescent, young adult, etc. We have names. Some of those names define very well-defined demarcations. So we know when a toddler begins to toddle, right? So the difference between a toddler and a baby, well, babies don't yet toddle. They stay put when you plunk them down in the middle of the living room. Toddlers do not stay put. Some of these boundaries are pretty clear. Adolescence begins at a pretty clear point. Puberty is a pretty, you know, it's stretched out over, it doesn't happen on a Thursday, you know, it takes place over some time, but it's pretty clear and it's pretty striking when if you have younger siblings, and because you observe it more in other people than in oneself, and you saw the transformation over a 6-month period, it's pretty impressive when you hit those changes. The end of adolescence is a little vaguer. Now, some people stay adolescents for a very, very long time. It's not quite the same as chronological age, but okay, there's stages. Is human history like that? Is it? Is that a reasonable way of thinking about it? And if it is, can we actually explain that trajectory? It's a pretty ambitious thing to try to do. And one might all say, well, even if we can, what's the point? What does this give us? Well, in the Marxian case, if you could really do it, it gives you something pretty important. Because it gives you a general abstract way to think about the future, about where we're going, not just where we've been. If it gave us no insights into where we're going, it would be interesting from an intellectual point of view, but it would not be important for the purposes for which Marxist theory is meant. Marxist theory, that this particular tradition, develops because it's a way of thinking about human emancipation. That's what it is. It's a form of emancipatory social science. If that's not important, you know, I know it's important to all of us, but if it isn't an important part of your agenda, then there's no big loss to not have a theory of history that doesn't tell you anything about where we're going, because that's not the central thing you care about. The general theory is one way of doing this. If we could have a general abstract theory that explains all of the stages, then it explains also the stages yet to come. Marxism also, though, has a fallback. You know, it's a second theory, which is not logically dependent on the first theory. And that's really important to, I think, understand. Historical materialism as a general theory of history can say, no, it doesn't work. And yet the special theory of capitalist history could still be valid. That is, we could have a good, solid theory of the laws of motion of capitalism, of its developmental tendencies, which point towards its destination, even if that's not a sub-theory of a more general theory of history. Marx really saw these as fitting together. He didn't work on that very much. That is, he didn't sit back and say, okay, how do all these pieces fit together into a comprehensive articulation of a general theory and a special theory? He didn't do that. Subsequent Marxists in different ways have done that, tried to do that. But it's important to note that they're not inherently connected. They don't, in the sense that if the general theory is unsatisfactory, it doesn't follow from that that the special theory is unsatisfactory. There may be independent reasons for the weaknesses of the special theory, but you do see how if you are convinced of the general theory and you found flaws in the special theory, then you would say, well, since I am still convinced that the general theory is right, I should put more effort into reconstructing the special theory to figure out how to make it better, because you'd have reason to believe it was a possible theory because you're applying the more general one. It's as if, for example, you have a general theory of biological evolution, and then you have a particular theory of the evolution of mammals, and it just keeps turning out the particular theory of the evolution of mammals that you have runs into difficulties. You know, the evidence just doesn't match the theory. Well, since you believe in the general theory of evolution, you wouldn't therefore say, because my theory of the evolution of mammals isn't working very well, mammals must not have evolved. No, you'd say, I just haven't got it right yet. So the general theory of historical materialism does serve purposes. Gives confidence in the search for a special theory, and its independent support for the idea that we can understand the destination of capitalism. Okay, that's all rehashing things, sort of, I've said before. Today what I'm going to do is criticize the general theory, show some places where I think it can be reconstructed, where you can create a version of it that still has some credibility. But in the end, I don't think all the pieces fit together very well. On Thursday, we'll then turn to the special theory of capitalist history. I will lay out the central arguments that both Marx and other Marxists have argued for how we can know from the vantage point of being inside of capitalism where it's headed. So I'll give the account of the special theory and then evaluate each of its central arguments, which I also find problematic. The punchline of the entire endeavor of these 2 weeks is that I don't think historical materialism as a theory of history is sound. I think, therefore, it's probably better to think of the Marxist tradition as what I sometimes call sociological Marxism, rather than historical materialism. You could also call it sociological materialism, but the word materialism has all sorts of connotations right now that make it a little bit tricky as a term. I just prefer to think of Marxism as fundamentally, at its core, a sociological theory. That is, it's a theory of the consequences of structures, of their contradictions and dilemmas, but not of some overarching developmental trajectory. It doesn't mean it has to be ahistorical in the other senses of an historical theory, that is, context-specific, with legacies of the past being a central part of your explanation of the present. Sociological Marxism can be historically specific accounts of dilemmas, contradictions, and possibilities, but that doesn't make it a theory of history. Be an historical theory without it being a theory of history. All right, that's where we'll end up. Now let's look at the critiques of classical historical materialism. I'm going to look at five criticisms. The first is the development thesis. The development thesis in Cohen, remember, is this sort of starting point argument stated in its simplest form, that the forces of production have a tendency to develop in history. So there is a underlying tendency for forces of production to develop, and this is what sets in motion the possibility of a directionality to history. Another Cohen, Joshua Cohen, who's a philosophy professor at Stanford, has been pretty critical of the development thesis. He emphasizes that while Cohen may be right about human motivations and circumstances, we live in a world of scarcity and we have the intelligence to solve problems and to improve things, there's no reason to imagine that this individual motivation is universally translated into any interest whatsoever in the development of the forces of production. And there are simply too many possibilities for the forces of production to be blocked to say that there's any net tendency for them to develop, in his view. There are other ways of enhancing material welfare. Conquest, increasing exploitation, moving to a more favorable environment. Humans migrated around the world because they thought they could improve their material conditions. There's lots of ways of doing it. aside from developing the forces of production. Blockages of the forces of production, therefore, shouldn't be thought of as pathological impediments. They're just one of the possibilities. So Cohen's basic critique of Cohen, Joshua's of Jerry's view, is there just is not a sufficient inherent drive for the development of the force of production to call it an overarching imminent tendency. The counter tendencies could indeed just permanently block it and it'd be no big deal. It's just the way things would be. That's Joshua Cohen's view. Okay, I think there's a response to that criticism. The response doesn't say that there's an inherent drive for the forces of production to develop, but it makes a softer claim, which can be stated this way, that the long-term probability of the development of the forces of production is greater than zero and greater than the probability of their regression, but not necessarily greater than stagnation. So we have three possibilities at any point in history for talking about any time frame into the future. So at any point in history, we can ask the question, in the next 100 years, what's the probability that the forces of production will improve, that they'll remain the same, that they will decline? And we can ask that at any time in history. We can just, this is a simple probabilistic statement. We can ask it for every community. We can ask it globally, for the world as a whole. What's the probability of them improving, stagnating, or declining? I think all you need for the development thesis is that the probability of advance is greater in the long term than the probability of regression. They both can be extremely small, and stagnation can be overwhelmingly the highest probability. So just to take a kind of simple, this is just an arbitrary arithmetic example. Suppose the probability of stagnation is 90%. So there's a 90% chance that the forces of production will not improve. And the probability, forgetting for a moment the probability of regression. We can add that in a moment. And the probability of advance is only 10%, that there'll be some small improvement is only 10% over some specified period, let's say over a 100-year period. This means in two successive 100-year periods, the probability of stagnation is only 0.81%, right? You just multiply them together. Over four centuries, it's only 0.35, only 35%. And in 1,000 years, it's 0.01. And in four successive, it's 35. In 1,000, my notes aren't very clear here. Anyway, you get the point. You keep multiplying this out. Eventually, so then the question is, as long as the probability of, so if you want to ask the question, what's the probability of net advance, you have to subtract the probability of regression from the probability of advancing. So if the probability of advancing is 0.8 and the probability of regression is 0.08 and the probability of regression is 0.02, then the probability of advancing is only 0.06, but you'll still get a slow increase. Now, why would we think that the probability of advancing is greater than the probability of regression? That's the key issue. As long as you believe that that's true, that the probability of an improvement of the forces of production is greater than the probability of their deterioration, as long as you believe that's true, in the long run, then you do get development. Well, I think the argument for that centers around Cohen's point that the key issue in the development of the force of production is knowledge. And so long as it is the case that knowledge is not lost, then gains in knowledge will be sticky downward, and therefore our capacity to do things will be sticky downward. Sticky downward means it's a kind of expression for a ratchet-like process where once you reach a point, it's sticky. It doesn't move down as easily as it stays where it is. So once you've reached a point, it'll stay where it is at a much higher probability than regress, even if there's not much chance to move forward. But on the rare occasions where it does move forward, it stays there. And I think the key reason for that sticky downwardness is because of knowledge. Knowledge is what's at the heart of the forces of production. And if there's anything like that going on, and I think this assumption seems a reasonable way of interpreting the development of the forces of production over history, then you'll get at least a weak form of the development thesis. And all you need is the weak form. You don't need a strong form where human beings from time immemorial are constantly trying to improve the forces of production. They can be perfectly content and not be constantly trying. Now, there's an interesting kind of set of anthropological arguments about about communities of modern peoples, that is peoples who live in the world today, who have lived in extremely isolated environments but which are prolific in nature, which provide the means of subsistence without scarcity. So there are tropical areas where there's no variation across time. You don't have to worry about good years and bad years, where population densities are extremely low, and which there's an abundance of the basic stuff of life, and in which people don't have to work very hard to get it. Now, those kinds of environments typically engender communities that are very egalitarian, with lots of reciprocities, and in which there does not appear to be any strong tendencies at all, or even weak tendencies, for the forces of production to develop. If the whole world was like that, then perhaps there would be no tendency for the forces of production to develop. But the whole world isn't like that. All right, that's the first thesis, the development thesis. And by the way, on this class, I think the best thing is just to ask questions connected to each of these elements as we go through. Any things? Yeah, Kate.
So it sounds almost like a geographical determinism type of theory where you have seasonal flows and scarcity over time or temporal differences, you'll have development of forces of production. It's higher probability.
Yeah, so the more general statement is where there are risks and uncertainties that people have to contend with and which they come to recognize. So it's basically an argument about scarcity, where people live in a world of scarcity. So Cohen's premise is human beings have a set of capacities, intelligence and problem-solving abilities, and we live in a certain kind of environment, a world of scarcity, where we have to expend effort to satisfy our needs. Now, if you live in an environment where that really isn't true, even if you then have the intelligence and problem-solving capacity, there won't be any, not just pressure, but any advantages particularly to developing the forces of production. They won't accomplish anything that would be recognizable. If you push this point a lot, it gets very hard to know how you would know how much scarcity you need, how much uncertainty you need, and exactly how does it work in different kinds of human communities. And I don't have any particular informed views on that issue. Yeah?
I was going to say, I could imagine like a situation in which the opposite would happen, where if a society is like very democratic in the way that it decides to produce things, then you might see that a community comes together, even though they don't have that much work to do, they decide that they want to develop the forces of production further so that they have even less work to do.
But they might, it's possible they would. It depends upon how little work they already have to do as to whether that is in any way oppressing, would provide any motivations. After all, with all of our modern technology and stuff, when we go on a camping trip, there's not a whole lot of pressure to be super efficient about it because it's not really experienced as work. It takes a few hours to set up camp and prepare it. But if nature was providing, so you bring food from the grocery store, but if it was just as much effort, we spend a certain amount of effort going to the store to buy the stuff. If it was that easy to get stuff from nature directly, whether there would be any imperative, even if people got together democratically, and if they got together as a community to decide what to do, I don't see why through deliberation they would have the idea, maybe we could improve the efficiency with which we do what? Gather fruit, but they would say, look, the fruit's right there, I don't think, in any case, I don't think forces of production develop through that kind of process. It's in hunting and gathering societies in early civilization, in early societies before settled agriculture, it was pretty much, I think, just through what is probably best thought of as random events. Somebody with an imaginative capacity observing something and realizing, oh yes, we can use this for some purpose, yeah.
So when other societies, in a geographical setting, say that there's society A and society B, and society A lives by the lake, or whatever, and so has less scarcity than society B, but society B develops their forces of production because they have more scarcity, right? But if they interact, will that interaction lead to the necessity of the other society to develop their forces of production further? Would interaction between societies factor into development?
It could. And that's another kind of story one can tell, particularly if you feel that the driving force of history, for example, is violence. So an alternative non-Marxian theory for the development of the forces of production centers around military, not around the development of the force of production as such. It's the development of coercion, of violence. That's the driving force. That makes it exogenous to the internal social relations of production. The Marxian framework in the general theory says that you have forces and relations of production which define a particular mode of production. That mode of production prior to classes is called primitive communism. Internal to that mode of production, there's a slow development of the forces of production, which eventually hit the limits of possibility under those relations of production. And that's the fettering argument, in which then a superior set of relations of production, superior with respect to the development of the force of production, emerge eventually. And the mechanism in the Marxian account is endogenous conflict and contradiction and experimentation rather than conquest of one society over another. Once you get the breakthrough, then conquest can be a mechanism. But the breakthrough comes from endogenous processes. Okay, so that's the first thing, the development thesis. I think the development thesis taken by itself is pretty reasonable. I think if you take this probabilistic view and the sticky downward thing, it seems to me that we have a big enough planet with a big enough range of variations in conditions that human beings find themselves, that the idea that there will be slow experimentation from time to time that creates sticky downward advance of the forces of production And eventually this reaches a level where surpluses can be produced, namely settled agriculture becomes a development of the force of production. You get changed conditions under which new relations can be formed. And that's all that you really need for the development thesis itself. Okay, the second part of the argument, though, is the idea that the forces of production functionally explain the relations of production. When you ask the question, why are the relations of production the way they are? Why are they the way they are? The answer is because given the level of the forces of production, those are the relations best suited for the future development of the forces of production. You explain the relations by their consequences for the development of the forces of production. That's Cohen's argument about the functional relation between the forces and relations of production. Functional relations also take place on the Bayes superstructure argument. Why is ideology the way it is? Because it stabilizes the class structure or the mode of production. The functional argument for superstructures is, I think, has more immediate plausibility, even if it has problems, than the functional analysis, the functional argument for the relations of production. Even if we accept the legitimacy of functional explanation for the Bayes superstructure problem as at least being a candidate explanation, part of the explanation, the critical issue for historical materialism is whether it is plausible to say that the forces of production functionally explain the relations of production. This is what Cohen calls the primacy thesis. So what Cohen in his book calls the primacy thesis, the primacy of the forces of production over the relations of production, the primacy thesis is this functional explanation of the relations by the forces. Functional explanation of the relations of production by the forces of production. Just to repeat it again, the primacy thesis states this: the social relations of production take the form that they do because given the level of development of the forces of production, these are the relations most suited to the further development of the forces of production. If that were true, we could say the forces functionally explain the relations. Now, the main criticism of this explanation concerns the problem of a plausible general feedback mechanism, which explains how it comes to pass that the production relations are explained in this way by their beneficial effects for the development of the forces of production. It's one thing to say that certain forces of production can only be used under certain relations of production. That's just an empirical claim about how you need compatibility between the forces and the relations of production. It's one thing to say that they need to be compatible. If you try to create relations of production that cannot use the existing forces of production, they will deteriorate. They won't be stable. They won't be sustainable. So you can talk about the compatibility of relations and forces of production. That's a different claim, however, from saying that the relations that we have are selected because they optimize the subsequent development of the forces of production. The central criticism of historical materialism on this element is that there's no plausible general feedback mechanism to accomplish the selection of the relations on the basis of what's optimal for the development of the forces. The principal response then to this part of the argument is to shift the argument from optimality to simple compatibility, and to shift the discussion from the optimality for the development of the far, from the compatibility for the development of the forces of production to compatibility for the use of the forces of production. Given the level of development of the forces of production, some relations will simply not be possible. And if attempts are made to create them, they will be unsustainable. If you attempted to create capitalism under very primitive forces of production, capitalism would deteriorate. It simply would not be possible. This does not mean that these are that whatever compatible relations are necessarily the best for further developing the forces of production, but they must at least allow for the use of those forces of production. There's another issue connected to this, which I think is worth mentioning. Some of these discussions get philosophically pretty tricky, kind of murky, because of the methodological problems involved. It has to do with the level of abstraction of the primacy thesis. The actual connection between the relations of production and forces of production depends upon all sorts of variability within any abstract mode of production. The actual connection between the technologies and knowledge you have and the nature of the relations in which they're used depends upon all sorts of things other than the abstract mode of production. You know, this is obvious, I think, for capitalism. Whether capitalism stably promotes the development of the forces of production or becomes a predatory form of monopolistic rent-seeking, you know, whether you have predatory Congolese capitalism or dynamic Japanese or American capitalism, depends upon all sorts of things other than simply whether or not an economy is capitalist. It depends upon the presence of all sorts of other institutions that either promote or impede or block the effective operation of those capitalist mechanisms. And the same could hold for pre-capitalist modes of production. The extent to which forces of production could develop within them may depend upon all sorts of issues below the level of abstraction at which the theory is pitched. And that's another problem with this functional explanation, because if the real action depends upon all these other institutional conditions, not on the sheer abstract character of the relations of production, then the explanatory mechanisms aren't operating at the same level as the concepts which they're attempting to explain. All right, that's the second element, the problematic element. The critique of the functional explanation of the relations of production. And I think the main shift that's made to kind of accommodate that is to simply talk about compatibility. That the forces of production develop, the existing relations of production need to be at least compatible with the use of the existing forces of production for the system to be stable. But they don't need to be compatible with the future development of those forces of production. This leads to the next point, the critique of the inevitability of fettering of the forces of production. Now, this is really the pivotal point, I think. I mean, there may be more than one pivotal point, so it's a pivotal point in historical materialism. Because historical materialism as a grand general theory of history has this character of arguing that there's this continuous, if uneven, development of the forces of production. They hit barriers of relations of production, and that barrier eventually is broken through. But that barrier cannot be a permanent fettering. So fettering has to, in the long term, trigger some kind of crisis process that leads to an unfettering, right? That's the key part of the argument. Now, the transformation thesis, which we'll discuss in a moment, can be criticized on the grounds that even if there is fettering, it doesn't mean that there's going to be transformation. Why can't fettering just be permanent? What's to prevent fettering from just being permanent? That's the problem with the transformation thesis. But there's also the question of whether fettering is inevitable. That is, why should we believe that it's the case as a general law-like proposition that within all modes of production based on class relations, eventually the production relations will fetter the forces of production? Why should we believe that's true? Marx never actually provides an argument for that. I don't think you can find any abstract argument for the general claim that forces of production, that the relations of production will inevitably fetter the forces of production. The most one can say is something like this. In class societies, the relations of production create powerful classes that have interests in maintaining their power and privileges derived from those relations. That's true. Class societies create classes with an interest in protecting their privileges and thus in stabilizing and maintaining those class relations. So they build and defend superstructures which preserve those relations and therefore create a certain kind of social rigidity. I think we can also say that with pretty good confidence, that ruling classes enforce a certain kind of rigidity in the society because they want to prevent changes of the sort that would erode their power and privileges. This rigidity might tend to become a fetter on the development of the forces of production if it's the case that the further development of the forces of production would destabilize their relations. That's one of the things superstructures might do, is block the development of the force of production because that would be a threat to the relations of production. But why should that be a general law as opposed to a specific observation about particular cases? So we might be able to make this argument for European feudalism in the 15th and 16th centuries. But why should it be true as a general abstract proposition about all pre-capitalist relations? And if it isn't true in general, then the general law isn't valid. You'd have a special theory of feudal relations of production, just like we have a special theory of capitalist relations of production, but not a general theory that all pre-capitalist relations have this character of destabilizing fettering. And in particular, is this argument at all credible for capitalism? In fact, this seems to be exactly what capitalism has accomplished: incredible institutional flexibility and ability to transform itself in ways that respond to whatever crisis tendencies might otherwise threaten the reproduction of the system as a whole. The nature of capitalist relations have changed dramatically over time. It is not simply the case that the abstract category, capitalist mode of production, does a very good job at explaining the huge variation in types of capitalism that we observe. Partially, this variation over time is the result of responses, adaptive responses to crisis. But it's also the result of the ways in which capitalism always combines within itself hybrids of capitalist and non-capitalist relations, which makes the system way more flexible than you would predict if you regard capitalism as nothing but capitalism. Part of the robustness of capitalism as a system of economic relations comes from the fact that all capitalist systems are hybrids. They all contain non-capitalist elements which make the system way more flexible than would be predicted. And it's therefore not at all obvious that capitalism has any tendency to fetter the development of the forces of production. The forces of production seem to continue to develop in extraordinary and unpredicted ways, in spite of all the harms that capitalism creates in the world. Cohen recognizes this problem. that this general claim that all class relations ultimately fetter the development of the forces of production, that this inevitability of fettering thesis just doesn't seem to have a lot of credibility for capitalism. He doesn't say, but I think it's also true, it's not so obvious why it should always be true even for pre-capitalist societies, that they inevitably fetter the development. But it's certainly, for capitalism, the evidence is that there isn't this kind of fettering. He proposes to shift the analysis from development fettering to what he calls use fettering. This, I think, is a absolutely correct move on his part. I think he's exactly identified how you have to think about the forces and relations of production in capitalism and the nature of the contradictions between them, that it's not a contradiction between the development of the forces of production and the relations of production, but a contradiction between the use of these forces of production and the relations of production. The core idea here, then, I think, is a familiar one. Capitalism creates a world of unbelievable productivity, yet it perpetuates toil and poverty on a massive scale. And that means that the use of our forces of production increasingly diverge from the possible well-being of people. The gap between the kinds of lives we could live because of our productivity and the lives we do live because of the capitalist organization of this productivity is the fundamental irrationality of the system. Sort of the deep irrationality of the system is this growing gap between the lives we could live and the lives we do live, where I'm using we in the expansive sense. Eliminable human suffering and alienation in a world capable of sustaining human emancipation and flourishing is the irrationality of capitalism. Now that is, I think, critical to our diagnosis and indictment of capitalism. But irrationality, unfortunately, generates much weaker predictions about the future than the previous notions of fettering did. Because as we'll see specifically when we look at the special theory of capitalism on Thursday, the stronger arguments about fettering made the system unsustainable. It was unreproducible by virtue of the fettering. The fettering actually undermined its capacity for reproduction. An irrational system doesn't necessarily, or an undesirable, irrational in the sense of profoundly undesirable, with serious moral deficits and a flourishing gap, this doesn't make a system intrinsically unsustainable. The key point then of the fettering thesis was to create the stage for the kind of crisis that systems could not resolve without transformation. And the irrationality of the system, its undesirability, doesn't accomplish that. It does provide motivations for transformation, for struggle, but it doesn't provide a prediction of the unreproducibility of the system, which is, again, what the overall theory of history was meant to do, because that would be what explains why you move from one stage to another and why you can predict that movement in advance. All right, that's the fettering of forces of production, the third item. I think we should take our break, and we have two more items on the critical list. Let's reconvene, 14 after. And that'll give us time both for discussion and finishing up.